Everybody, and welcome to the Janet Foster Show, where you get real talk you can act on. I just want to thank everybody so much for last week, your support and your comments, your live tweets, and we can do it again. You can hit me up right now on Twitter and Instagram at Janet D. Foster, and that's Janet and D for Deborah. And you can hit me up on Facebook at Janet Foster there on the page. And we actually have today's show announcement on there, so you can start posting there. And, you know, just as usual, it's like Grand Central Station here. I've got everything up. And I just want to say to everyone who's listening, you know, sometimes here in Los Angeles, people get a little... you know, a little caught up in Hollywood just a bit. And of course, this is prime time. So a lot of people are either at work, you're commuting. So some of you are listening in your cars. Some of you are on Metro listening. No matter where you are, I appreciate you listening. And I know we've got listeners across the country. And just another big shout out to Chicago. A lot of people from Chicago. And actually, you told me that I should have given you guys a shout out. There were quite a few of you. And big shout out to Big Ted. Big Ted, you know, in your commentary about the Flint water crisis last week was one of those moments that, you know, I think you aren't the only one. And it seems as the weeks go on, we're now in week three after that city being called into an emergency, you know, basically in a state of emergency. And I just want, you know, as we go through this again, tonight's show is a follow-up in the sense of that show, because we got so many comments, and I listed a lot of the failures that went on to protect the people of Flint. And the more and more we learn, we just learned that there's more and more accountability. The EPA director has resigned. And I think they're still, like I said last week, there are going to be more heads rolling. There's more going on. You know, here in Hollywood, we're in the midst of awards season. So there are some people caught up about who didn't get nominations. But also in the news cycle today, quite a few of us who are journalists, we've been following stories, and some of us have been asked to research stories on celebrities who have been supporting Flint and, you know, out front, share from just the point of announcement. She started sending bottled waters. And then last week, five semi-trucks that she pulled together to send things out. And then Pearl Jam. And then, of course, today, the biggest news in today's news cycle was a combination of Wiz Khalifa, Eminem, Mark Wahlberg, and Sean Puffy Combs. They combined together, and they have begun to send aid and send water to the people of Flint. And of course, you know, another day one, and he's a Flint resident. You know, Michael Moore, he reps Flint hard. And for listeners who may not have caught my tweets during the week, the latter part of last week, Michael Moore has started a petition. And I think it's something that I tweeted it out, and I'll tweet it out again. It's something that I think people should consider signing and looking at. And it breaks down... and basically, Michael Moore is pushing for not only accountability, but also he's asking for legal. Some people need to withstand criminal actions in the petition. So think about that. And, you know, like we ended last week's show, you know, depending on where you live in the country, so many of us could be living in a Flint situation. And with today's show, I want to highlight a group that I've been watching the Flint situation for the past month. Actually, from a news perspective, a reporter perspective, and getting information. And one particular group last week that was very active on social media and interactive with me on social media. And I am familiar with this group's work. And I feel like, you know, this show, we're so avant-garde in the topics that we talk about, but also one of the things that you, the listeners, have been so great with me in terms of feedback has been you like the guests that we have on, that they actually have something to say and they and they're actually doing something for the greater good. And this particular group I wanted to highlight, Islamic Relief USA, because one of the things that I've noticed is based on faith-based groups, national coordinated faith-based groups, this organization has been on point and involved with the situation in Flint before it became large in the media cycle. And when I say large in the media cycle, it's where it's on every single channel and you're hearing about it. And particularly for those of us here in California and also here in Los Angeles, since we are the number two media market, a lot of times a lot of news from parts of the country get sifted out. And a town like Flint, the size of Flint, is almost, it could fit in part of one of the neighborhoods that make up LA. So sometimes certain stories in the news cycle get filtered out of our news here in Los Angeles. But before this became a hot topic, before things were snowballing, this group was in action. And I have a guest on the line today. His name is Minkelu Jala. Minkelu, are you on the line?
I am on the line. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. And I want to make sure, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Because
I
want. That's always the first question. you know, it was. You did a good job. You were almost there.
I was almost there. Help me get 100% there. Because see, I like to get it right.
It's like a fun game that I play with people when I first meet them. Pronounce my name. But my name is Minkelu. Minkelu Jallo.
Minkelu Jallo. Got it.
Yeah.
I'll be on point for the rest of the interview. I promise.
God willing.
Well, I, you know, I'm so happy that you're able to be here with me and to talk to us today about your group and about your work. And
it's my pleasure.
And what I want to do is for just to give our audience some context here. Can you give us, describe to us and give us kind of the details about your group, what your group is about, and how you came about and how long you've been doing what you're doing before we get into a lot of the activities that you're involved in?
Sure. So Islamic Relief USA is the U.S. branch of a family, actually, of organizations all throughout the world. I think we're actually located or at least working in 42 countries around the world broadly. But we've been in the United States now for more than 20 years. And we are really across the board as a humanitarian organization. We are involved in any number of projects from water, sanitation, and health, to agricultural development. Emergency is one of our relief, you know, disaster relief has been one of our big areas.
Mm-hmm.
We've kind of had that as a niche for a really long time, but, you know, we have a lot of development programs going on throughout the world as well. We do peace building in a lot of different countries, even psychosocial services in some places. It's really across the board. In the United States as well, we're very active. And have increased our activity here in the U.S. quite a bit over the last couple of years, especially. But that's the general overview. I can give you more specifics if you like right now. We can get into that later.
Okay. For our audience, what I find impressive about this group is the fact that they are quickly mobilized. And Minkailu, you mentioned some things about water, sanitation, and things right. that you do. And I know you said that your organization is present in 42 countries. You know, just the thought of doing this in what is quote unquote supposed to be a modern country where you guys got involved in Flint. Can you give us kind of an account and your updates? Because I know that you've been on the ground there in Flint. Can you give me some of your thoughts and observations of what's going on in Flint? And then talk to us about how your organization is working to supply and address some of the needs of the residents.
Sure. So I actually just returned from Flint this morning. I woke up to a very sunny day in the beautiful city of Flint, Michigan. But it's a really depressing situation, unfortunately. And you're right that it is something like you would expect to see in another country. People have to remember the context of Flint as well as the current situation. This is a city that really, since the 60s, I think, has been in decline. You know, it's been faced with deindustrialization, depopulation, generally speaking, urban decay. It's had an incredibly high crime rate since the early 2000s. It's faced two financial disasters in the recent past, I think just in the past 10, 15 years. And all of that kind of came together to really make it something of a, it almost, it, honestly, being there in Flint, it really was reminiscent of a war zone. Everywhere you go, there's just vacant, abandoned buildings, roofs caved in. And this was before the situation arose with the water.
Mm-hmm.
And now that added to it, it's just kind of a perfect storm. And, my heart really goes out to the people of Flint and the situation that they're dealing with. You know, as it stands currently, I mean, the water, they say, of course, that, with the filters and things of that nature, it's okay at this point. But, that's not really the perspective of the residents of Flint. They're not using the water, whether they have a filter or not. They're not interested in that. They don't trust the government. They don't trust what anyone's telling them. They don't want to hear that.
I don't blame them.
They're completely relying on bottled water at this point. They're bathing in it. They're drinking it. They're cooking with it, brushing their teeth with it, essentially everything. I was kind of, even myself, working in the development field, the idea of just handing out bottled water, for me, it seems somewhat of a inadequate response to any kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went there to Flint, I really saw that these people really just need water. They need water, and they need it badly because they don't have a source of water, which is a crazy thing to say in the United States of America, but it's just a fact out there that there's really not a safe source of water for these people to have. And it's obviously causing a lot of difficulty,
Definitely.
I went to many people's homes. I sat with a lot of people. You've got a lot of seniors in Flint with limited mobility, people who were telling me that they couldn't even afford the bus fare to go to the water distribution sites and pick up more cases of water.
Mm-hmm.
People who had no transportation whatsoever. People are really having a difficult time out there. And unfortunately, there is not at this point much of a solution to the problem available. It's something that I think is going to take a long time to fix. And I realistically think that these people are going to be relying on, water being carted in essentially for anywhere from 12 to 18 months, maybe more.
Oh,
and
wow.
considering the fact that we do have, you know, a kind of national psyche that revolves around, you know, cycles, things become hot and then they're ignored after that. I kind of am afraid for what's going to happen when this does leave the media, and when it does stop trending, when people aren't talking about it anymore, and when the donations start to dry up. Because right now, you know, thank God they're being inundated with water to the point that, you know, the organizers of the response are having difficulty even managing the degree that is coming in, the supply that's coming in.
Right.
So that's a good thing, and I definitely, you know, I have a lot of hope in myself that I think gained out there, just seeing the generosity of the American public, people who were, you know, sending things out there. It was really overwhelming, honestly, to see the response.
Right.
It was also sad that this response had to come from the American public. You know, that there's not a more coordinated effort on the part of certain organizations, institutions that have more resources, agencies and authorities of the government, perhaps, that could have been engaged a little bit quicker. But, you know,
absolutely. Yeah.
It's an evolving thing, so I don't want to criticize. I don't know necessarily the inside details of that. The focus really, though, is the people of Flint, and they've certainly benefited from the generosity of people out there.
Yeah, and what I want to ask you about your organization, how did your organization get tapped into working to pull donations together and get to people to Flint? Are there people like yourself that monitor these things, and then you go back to your group and then you deploy out? Or just how did your group get involved? Because one of the things that I've been learning from a lot of faith-based organizations is some are not as coordinated as your group.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of, I think, eagerness to do good in the faith-based community.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get get lots of people who are very excited to go out and do something, but a lot of times they maybe don't consider what the logistical requirements of, you know, sustained activity in a disaster or a crisis might be.
Right.
Fortunately for us, we've actually had a disaster response team that's been developed over the past few years. I mean, we've been active throughout the United States. I think we've got about 2,500 volunteers all over the country who have been trained. We work directly with the Red Cross to train our volunteers.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
And to have them, you know, ready to go at a moment's notice wherever it is that there happens to be a situation. So, you know, we are used to, I think, more so than others, perhaps, the circumstances like this. And we do like to be prepared to move quickly. In this instance, actually, it was, you know, we're very, internally we're very, and externally, but internally we're a very collaborative organization. You know, I take suggestions. We have separate departments like every organization, and I take suggestions from people if they have a good idea. Everyone's open to it. It was actually one of our board members who really first brought up the idea of us, you know, we should be responding to this Flint situation, although other people had been thinking about it. But, you know, that was more than enough to get us activated to get out there as quickly as possible. And for us, actually, we didn't really wait for donations in terms of water. We just we just placed an order and had it sent out there as quickly as we could.
That
our first.
I'm aware of that. That was very impressive. That's when I learned about your presence there in Flint. That you guys you guys just immediately showed up. And something that you shared, and I didn't mean to cut you off so quickly, but. Something that you shared that I wasn't aware of with your organization. You mentioned that you sometimes partner with other organizations in a group like the Red Cross. you know, that's something that...
Quite frequently.
Yeah, and you do that here in the States. And did you, by any chance, also rely on some of your resource information from parts of your organization outside the U.S. that may have, because, I mean, people here in the U.S., we're born to know you turn on the faucet and the water right. comes out. We don't right. know about how it is in, say, the Congo, where right. People have to walk miles to get water, or the same in, you know, the same in Argentina and parts of Argentina. So, you know, did you guys also consult with some of your folks outside the country?
Well, actually, in this instance, we didn't really have to. We had people internally who, you know, they deal with international projects on a regular basis, uh-huh. and they had a lot of good ideas in terms of, you know, what were some potential things that we could do. Obviously, the water, you know, was the first big thing. Because it's really, like I said, it's very necessary. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we definitely have the benefit of many people at our organization who are experienced in a lot of different areas. So we certainly work with a lot of different groups outside outside of the country. For this one, we were pretty well prepared to take it on.
Oh, excellent. And I know before I cut you off, you were talking about how you guys just placed the order for the water, and then you just showed up in motion. And then I'm assuming right. that you engaged your network after you got yeah. there on the ground.
So there's a strong community in Flint, particularly the Muslim community is very active out there. Mm-hmm. And we have absolutely partnered with the local organizations that are working out there. In fact, you know, that's kind of been our model in the United States, to work with community-based organizations that are, you know, always in their community serving people, or just, you know, providing information to people, or just engaging people as volunteers. Mm-hmm. In particular, in Michigan, there's a really strong organization, the Michigan Muslim Community Council, which sort of acts as a, you know, organizing body for the Muslim community generally in the state of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
They're located centrally in Detroit, but they're active throughout the state. And they've been a long-term partner of ours, and they, you know, immediately started, you know, trying to raise funds from their community to support the efforts that are happening there. They, you know, engage their community to come out and actually help us to go and distribute the water. So they've been really, really quite necessary. You know, they were a big help for us in getting this done. Another group in the Flint area that we worked with was the Sylvester Broom Empowerment Village.
Okay.
That's another kind of newer organization in the Muslim community over there that's, they've got a center that they recently purchased, and they've been collecting and distributing water out of that center. And they were kind enough to allow us to, utilize, some space to stage out of. So partnership, domestically and internationally is our primary model for getting things done. And we certainly think it's more sustainable to build the capacity of a community, as opposed to, you know, having them rely on outside help consistently coming in.
Yeah, definitely, because outside people have to eventually leave and go
right.
back. And it's easier if you've got people who have been engaged locally and they're able to pool their resources, and they still have you in the back pocket if they need you, but they're
right.
they're the ones that basically run the show, and you come in and help supply. Yeah. Great,
right.
great model. And you're exactly right. A lot of groups try to help out just in a lot of the viewing that I've been looking at. And I was thinking, you know, and something that you brought up, how people are not using any of the water, which I don't blame them. And last week I talked to our listeners about some of the photos. I've posted some of the photos and, you know, someone's washing machine. It's almost like when you look at that, you have to know something's wrong. And
these people were told for quite some time, and this was something that we heard from house to house. You know, they were told when water was coming out of their faucet brown, you know, it's okay, just boil it. And I was very sad to hear that, to be honest.
Yeah.
That's
crazy. And that's something that a lot of listeners were tweeting about, and especially for some of us that live here in parts of LA, there are just places here people will lose their mind over traffic, and they definitely would have been storming City Hall if it were in Beverly Hills. They would be storming, you know, and someone would be in City Hall, and it seems like there's no one in City Hall. It seems like that. It's almost as if their elected officials have gone into hiding. And the only elected official that's even around is the current mayor, because that mayor got elected. This didn't happen on that person's watch, so to speak. And it seems
they do love her. They love Mayor Weaver. We heard nothing but positive things about her.
Yeah,
but,
and she...
the people really do. They feel expendable. To be honest, they're not, you know, the people of Flint, they're not stupid people by any means, at all. They're very aware of the situation. They're very aware of what's going on, and that, you know, they're sort of in a position where they can be taken advantage of, you know, that's kind of permeated their feelings and about themselves and about their community, and it's a very kind of depressing attitude for a population to have. And it's you know, something that of course is not going to aid the development that's going to be required in Flint moving forward, because you really need to have the community kind of at the top of its game.
Exactly.
They seem a little bit just beaten back and depressed, and of course you can't blame them for that.
No, you can't. And you know, you've got people who are doing the best that they can, getting by, making it happen, and then all of a sudden their city government poisons them, so to speak, that, you know, with bad water, and then they lie about it, and then they're billing people for it. Which that just blows my mind to begin with.
Yeah, people have been cutting off their water quite a bit. They were still getting bills in the mail, and that was definitely we heard a lot of venting about that for sure.
Yeah, a lot of the interviews that I've done just with residents and kind of with some residents who've kind of take on activist roles with this, it's become ridiculous. And the fact that they were serious about it, that one person said they were actually serious. And I just thought, this is ridiculous. And for people who, they've got a lot of elected officials that must not live in that city, because I couldn't imagine people saying, oh yeah, the water's okay, everything's fine, and you go home after telling other people it's fine, and then you go turn on the faucets or go to do laundry or, you know, just anything to even do your dishes. You know, just to kind of change it up a little bit with the water donations, one of the things that I've been seeing is like with Cher's truck, Cher sent a caravan from here of semis. Actually, some drivers volunteered whatever she could buy up.
Did they have a big picture of her face on the side?
Yes, I think there was one on the trailer. Yeah,
That's awesome.
she was one of the first celebrities and just did it. And she's known to do that, those kinds of things. And, you know, people can say whatever they want about Cher, but she's on point.
Yeah.
And,
I got respect for that. I'm glad that she did that.
And, the thing about it is though, and you know, people are sending bottles of water. You know, I'm thinking about, and what I, you know, knowing that the people aren't using the water, after a while, they've got to do something about more portable, large, maybe containers of water and things like that. And that's sort of what I was interested in finding out about your organization, at what, you know, if you were using some strategy that's been done in other countries. Because, I mean, they, you know, again, here in the U.S., we don't think that something like that's needed. But in other countries, that kind of strategy is in play.
Yeah. And we've certainly been exploring those opportunities. Uh-huh. The idea of it is, it's odd, you know, to think about, like, for example, in other countries, you know, we'll have you'll have a giant water truck.
Yes.
That comes to the neighborhood. And it's an odd thing to think about, but that's something that we've been considering, amongst other things. But, you know, it's, as I said, they're going to need the water for quite some time. So I do think that larger storage solutions, that something also more locally based, something that's more centered in their neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
Would be much more efficient in terms of, because people are going back to the distribution hubs, you know, 3-4 times a week. And there's only, I think, about 6 of them at the local fire stations. And the deliveries, you know, the Red Cross is out there delivering every single day, and that's actually what we were doing with them on Saturday. We were out there delivering some of our water on the trucks, but you know, they're not hitting every single house every day. You know, people will receive their deliveries maybe once a week,
right?
Maybe twice a week at most, and so those things may become necessary as we move forward. And we, you know, see again the water donations decline, and the demand for water obviously will not decline.
Right.
You might see water trucks rolling through Flint, which would be, I wouldn't even know what to think of that sight.
That's exactly where I was going with that. In my mind, that's what I thought the next solution would be, because just thinking about. I've covered Hurricane
right.
Andrew in Miami, and there were water trucks in neighborhoods because the utilities were out in a lot of areas. And that's the first thing that comes to mind. And then hearing that there's no, there hasn't been any movement or any action in terms of dealing with the pipes. they cannot use the pipes, even if they've stopped pulling in the dirty water from the river. They can't use those pipes anymore because it's
right.
now because they were old to begin with. They've dislodged other particles, and they're going to have to redo it. I mean, the good thing is that there's a lot of there are jobs to be had. And
right, for sure.
and hopefully those jobs will go to Flint residents, you know, and things like that. But I do see that, you know, after being embarrassed like this, you know, that needs to happen. That just needs
right.
to happen. And
well, what we were hearing about the pipes was, you know, that realistically, I mean, that's like a 5, 10, maybe even 15-year project.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those pipes are very, very old, and they're very deep under the ground. I was talking to an engineer, actually, while I was out there, and he was telling me that they don't even know where some of them are.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
So they would have to dig just to find them before they could even replace them. And so that added, you know, that just adds to the complication of the whole situation. Overall, and yes, those pipes have been severely corroded at this point. You know, they're dumping all kinds of things into the water. You know, I don't know if you've heard, but they've had an increase in Legionnaire's disease.
Yes, yeah,
throughout
that was
the city.
Reported.
And of course, you know, correlation is not causation, but it makes sense that it's most likely coming from the contaminated water supply. It would be odd if, you know, the increase of Legionnaires came from some other random circumstance in Flint at this point.
Yeah, it's highly unlikely that there's cause from that. And the fact, the demographics, the age demographics that it's showing up in, it's highly irregular. It was the water supply, the exposure. Not only that, exposure to lead, and and I've saw reports. And quite a few of us in the media are trying to get be a part of a media call that we're with pediatricians and even OBs from that area, where there are mothers who were expecting, and they've since delivered. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about last week was, I think that entire community needs to be extended for life health care, because they need to be monitored. Well, without a doubt.
More so than that. You know, because right now, of course, the water is the primary need, and again, it will continue to be a big need in Flint. But what I want everyone to not forget in this, you know, kind of wave of excitement that's washing over the whole situation and across the country, is that, you know, the effects, lead is an extremely powerful neurotoxin.
Yes.
And it will essentially cripple a generation of children in Flint. I mean, we're talking 14 or 18 months, however long it was, where they had no idea. I mean, the water smelled funny and such, but they were being told it's completely fine. They had no idea that their kids were being exposed over and over and over again to lead. And there is no safe level of lead exposure.
Right.
These kids who have been exposed to lead, especially the kids, they're going to have learning disabilities. They're going to have all kinds of instances of ADHD and difficulties in general. Some of them, if it's gotten to that point, could even, you know, have mental retardation if the exposure is that severe.
Exactly.
And this is something that when you add to that poverty and we know that the education system as it stands currently is not very effective for elevating people out of situations of poverty. So when you have an impoverished impoverished population that is then dealing with learning disabilities, they are going to have a very, very difficult time, forget succeeding or lifting themselves out of their circumstances. They're going to have a very difficult time just getting by.
Yes.
And I can guarantee you in 10 years, 15 years, you're going to see crime rates increase in that city. You're going to see the prison population swell, because this is what happens when you have a large group of people who have inadequate education and learning disabilities. And these things aren't, if they're not dealt with, I mean, that's really the only route that a lot of these people can go. And it's something that needs to be addressed now. There needs to be, along with the discussion about the water, there needs to be discussion about early childhood education.
Yes.
You know, there needs to be a discussion about interventions for these kids who are going to really have a difficult time in the very near future.
You nailed it.
It could be literally a whole generation. Kids in Flint.
You nailed it. And, you know, for our audience is primarily Gen Xers and millennials. And we've got some cool baby boomers that have been hanging out with us. And they know a lot. They know a lot about a lot of the lead paint initiatives from the 70s.
Right.
And one thing that that we talked about last week when we talked about Flint was, you know, there was a time in the U.S. where for miners, you know, from the coal mines, where there were specific screenings and they're actually procedural screenings that physicians would do to ask about certain diseases like black lung disease. And because a lot of the people who were exposed, the way they were exposed to contract black lung, a lot of them have passed on, which means we've moved on to generations that haven't been exposed like that. For Gen Xers and millennials, because we're going to be the leaders, the citizen activists, and even the, I would even say some of the charitable leaders that are going to be around in the next 10 to 15 years when we start seeing the effects of Flint, that definitely I think this is a call to action for generations and for something. And since we're in the middle of an election year, no matter where you are in the country, this is something that we should generate discussion with a lot of these candidates that are in our face, skinning and grinning, that want to be, you know, they want the job. So we need to start giving them better job interview questions. That's kind of the way I list it, as it's a job interview.
It's not enough to just kiss the babies anymore. You have to educate them and take care of them.
Exactly. No more kissing the babies or the whole press the flesh kind of thing.
That's weird.
They actually have to be coherent. They have to do a real job. They can no longer have these high-priced consultants telling them what to say and what to do and things like that. And these are the questions that I think we should ask. And you brought up some excellent points about the future of Flint. I want to kind of move away from Flint and talk about some of your other good works. One of the things that I'm aware of, too, is that you guys were involved with helping out with the Nor'easter that just happened, too. Can you talk to us about that?
That one, actually, I'm not sure about. I looked into that. I'm not 100% sure if we were involved in that and what our involvement would have been. So,
okay,
you'll have to forgive me for that.
That's all right. I know that you've done things in the past.
Yeah. We have. We've been involved, like, with Superstorm Sandy and a lot of the other Irene. Actually, Irene is when I got started with Atomic Relief, so typically we are involved with the storms. I've just been in Flint for a while, so maybe I missed something.
That's understandable.
You'll have to forgive me.
That's so understandable. That's so understandable. And for once, Michigan didn't get that kind of storm, which they don't need that, especially the people of Flint. They don't need that right now.
We were having a good time in Flint at a brisk 30-something degrees. It was nice, actually.
For Southern California, I'm already shivering. So.
Yeah, you know, I spent some time in West Africa, and if it's like 70 degrees, I get cold.
Yes, here it's like people feel like at 55, they just think, oh, man, it's a nor'easter here. So definitely know what's going on there. Well, then let's move along because I want you to share with us because we have an audience who is quite astute at what's going on with the Syrian refugees. And we have quite a few of our listeners who are in support of the U.S. Supporting refugees. I want to just get your feedback on the things that your group's doing here in the U.S. and abroad. Because the pictures, you know, the footage, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking what you see.
And that's been going on really for an unbelievable amount of time now. Eventually, I think people just kind of have become numb to it. But those people in Syria are really still suffering. And even just recently, I know that there was a lot of social media activity about, you know, several towns where people were literally starving.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and it was I mean, it was a terrible sight. But we have been involved in Syria really since the crisis began. You know, of course, we have a lot of supporters and donors from the Muslim community, and Syria is obviously a region that a lot of them are concerned about and interested in.
Right.
We've been doing some healthcare services for the refugees in Jordan, and generally a lot of different food assistance programs in Syria, actually, as well, not just in the refugee camps in Jordan or Lebanon or Turkey, but we've had people, you know, either ourselves or our partners, people we've been working with, working directly in Syria. And food security was a big thing for us, for the recently displaced populations. You know, there's been some programs around dialysis, kidney dialysis, improving services for that in the refugee camps. Winterization kinds of projects, providing people with coats and blankets and things like that, because contrary to popular belief, they do have winter over there. It's not all just a desert.
Exactly.
Desert all the time.
Yeah.
So that's been a concern, certainly, and especially in the refugee camps where people are just kind of struggling with very, very little resources. And again, water, sanitation, health projects we've been involved in with the Syrians. But also, you know, in the United States, we've become much more active in the recent past with refugees in general.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, that does include the Syrians now. But we've done a lot of refugee support services in the United States. Our system is set up to try to get people to be self-sufficient in a very short period of time.
Okay.
And unfortunately, sometimes, especially when you have people who are coming from conflict zones, people who are coming to a country with a language that they're not familiar with, who don't understand, like, our certification process for employment and things of that nature, after that 90-day period, you know, they can sort of just kind of be left to fend for themselves. And so ourselves and a lot of Islamic Relief and a lot of other organizations in the U.S. do step in at that point to kind of provide additional services. One of the programs that I'm particularly proud of that we did was a housing program specifically for refugees, which...
Oh, excellent.
Kind of like it was a match savings program, financial literacy, education. But a number of refugee families were able to purchase homes in the Baltimore area as a result of that program.
Oh, excellent.
It was very, very, very successful. And we did that in partnership with the International Rescue Committee, which is one of the big refugee resettlement organizations in the United States.
Now, that's fabulous.
It was good. It was very good. Very good project.
Oh.
But we kind of focus on with refugees, engaging people in the community to kind of aid in the assistance of the refugees, because that's really what they need.
Mm-hmm.
The reception that they receive in their communities can completely determine how successful they are. You've maybe heard of some of the circumstances in the past where, you know, a town was inundated with a refugee group and there was a backlash against them. You know, people were afraid, or they weren't familiar with this group of people, or they heard stories about these kinds of things or those kinds of things in the media. And so they kind of pushed against them being there. And that creates a whole slew of problems, especially when you're just coming and getting used to a new place.
Absolutely.
So it's always preferable if you can get the community members engaged in acting almost as mentors for the refugees and having them help them learn how the systems work here. You know, how to do something as simple as ride public transportation or go to the grocery store. These are things, you know, you take for granted. But when you're a stranger in a strange land, that assistance that you get from a neighbor could be your saving grace.
You know, you make a good point about that. And one of the things that I wanted to share with our audience is for your organization has been around for 20 years. And I know because I'm getting some I'm actually getting some emails from people who are saying they've been around for 20 years. Oh, my gosh. you guys have been just doing your thing. You've been doing the good work. And I think a lot of people are just not aware of what you're doing. And, you know, and it's things like this. And you, the point that you make about communities, being prepared and having open dialogue and things like that, that's happened a lot here in California. Definitely a lot here. And there are other communities across the country. And what I have noticed is locally, the Muslim community has become much more active in interfaith.
Yeah, there's a great community in Southern California.
Yeah, and interfaith activities, and I think that's a positive. And I think groups like yours, where you're doing other things that's not just religious based, but you're keeping your religious tenets by doing the right thing, because that's what that's ultimately what everyone is trying to do: be better people and to do the right thing and to do the right thing by mankind. And I think I think as more people become familiar with a lot of good works, I think fear, resistance, and I think overall ignorance. I use that word. I'll claim that word because a lot of people do things or say things and behave out of just not knowing any better or being ignorant of what is truth. And by your organization's work, it's phenomenal. And definitely you guys are on point. And one other question I wanted to ask you in relation to the refugee camps, are you on a national scale? Outside of the Middle East, is your organization also working with some of the camps, say, in Germany as well, or coordinating services that way?
Yeah, actually, I do know that we our CEO was recently in Germany.
Okay.
I don't know specifically what the situation was, but I do think that we were providing some support for the refugees that ended up in Germany. But we do work outside of the Middle East. I mean, that is one of quite extensively. That is one of our major areas.
Right.
But we have programs in China. You know, we have programs in Indonesia.
Okay.
We have programs all over Africa. We have a great program in Central African Republic, working with all Christians, Muslims, everyone, peace building projects out there. So we're all over, really. We don't base, you know, any of our decisions in terms of where we're going to work on the faith of a particular group of people.
Right.
While we are, again, as you said, guided by our values of faith, for us, what's important is actually bringing benefit to the people, taking care of the people.
Excellent.
And that comes first. So,
excellent.
You know, we go where we're needed and we do what's necessary.
Well, with that said, that's going to be our final point for today. And one thing I want to ask you, if people want to contact your organization, they like what they've heard, maybe their organization wants to partner or even be a donor to your partner, how can people contact you?
Well, for general information, the best place to go would be irusa.org. Irusa.org, that's our website. If people want to talk about partnership, particularly in the United States, they can email me directly. I will publicly give out my email address, which may be a mistake, but it's mjalloh@irusa.org. And I'm happy to talk about, I work on all of our U.S.-based programs, and so I'm happy to talk about any kind of partnership opportunities or any kind of projects whatever it may be that people are interested in. And I can direct them as required if they want to discuss a different topic with someone else in our organization.
Well, thank you so much. And, Minkayla,
thank you for having me.
Yes, Minkayla, it was wonderful. You gave us some excellent information, and we will definitely keep in touch. And certainly you have a home on our microphone here at the Janet Foster Show. And you have a great week. And to our listeners, we'll be back same time, same place, and keep listening for more Talk for Action.